In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just speaking into the void? Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills. Wait, did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe, and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Joav Vilner, co-founder and CEO of Walnut.
You know, every time that we're working on a new video, we say, let's just push it and see if people are sick of it. It just helps us tell the story in a way that no other company is able to do it. And so every time we push the limits and boundaries, we just find out that the experiment has been successful.
This is Joav. He's a remarkable tech entrepreneur. He was the founder of one of the world's first tech marketing companies that helped 600 startups grow, and the founding CMO of an anti-bullying startup. He's been active as a startup mentor for accelerators by Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Yahoo, and the UN, and as a writer for top outlets such as Inc. Magazine, Forbes, CNBC, Entrepreneur, and more. In August 2020, he co-founded Walnut, which he leads as a CEO. With Walnut, he pioneered a category that enables sales pros to deliver interactive and unbreakable product demos. They also launched a movement for prospects that had to suffer through frustrating sales processes that took forever. And then they reinvented SaaS sales by enabling interactive product demos that focus on value at any stage of the sales process. Their mission? To solve the pain of buying software and create a way for prospects to fall in love with your product. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Joav to my podcast. We explore the journey of a startup that rapidly gained traction in the market. Joav explains why he prioritized brand building from day one and how that helped differentiate himself in a saturated sales product market. Last but not least, he elaborates on the power of creating a movement and what that did to growing their momentum in ways they couldn't expect. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, that you can capture immense value from the market even in the MVP stage. Secondly, how you can get potential customers to commit before you've even fully explained your product. Thirdly, Joav's lessons about how he leveraged external funding in a way that only creates winners. And lastly, why they took an aggressive approach to show as little as they could to prospects and why that paid off. Hi, Joav. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I mean, I reached out to you a while ago because, I mean, I saw a couple of things happening around your company and I started to look into like what you're doing. I got inspired by a number of things, one of them being the brand and how human you kind of get your message across. I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and it was already, for me, worth making a remark about. Now I also realize again how this conversation got going through LinkedIn itself. and why I got triggered, because your company got mentioned in a post that I did around sales demos. And that's how things sparked. And because your company, of course, is, yeah, I mean, if you look at your website, reinventing your sales process, it's all about the creating a completely new demo experience. And since that is something that I've always been passionate about in my full career, and I see that as a big problem that my typical customers have, you know, doing the harbor tours and losing everybody on the way. Yeah. I thought, okay, I have to get you on my podcast. So let's get going. Before we start talking about your company, Walnut, what drives you? What inspires you as a person?
That's a great question. I would say that just you kind of building things and seeing things that you build make an impact on someone. So with Walnut, it was a very fast, an immediate impact that we had. So it's just building things that someone needs, even if it's just one person.
Well, that's a very good way to start a company. Because if that's absent, you can have a company, but there's not a lot of traction going. Yeah, okay, well, let's switch then to the company itself and really what you've built. Started the company in August 2020 is what I saw on LinkedIn. You've seen some pretty interesting growth. Series B at the moment already captured in less than 3 years. So there's definitely something you do really well, and growth that you're seeing is picking up on a big problem. What was that big problem that you saw that made you think, okay, we're gonna solve this once and forever?
So first of all, I've never seen the market react so fast to the problem that you're trying to solve. Even when we were just at MVP, we couldn't even complete our sentences. Like if we told a salesperson or a VP of sales, we're going to disconnect you from relying on anyone from backend, from R&D, product design, they were like, just shut up and let's do it and take my money. A wait list of like 700 people started forming. It's a problem that everyone that ever worked at B2B have encountered. So it was, like yourself, it was just so easy to capture the value with our MVP. And so it started with problems that me and my co-founder saw in previous places. Yeah. And it turned into a whole landscape. Now interactive demos is like a whole big thing that's happening now in B2B.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're talking about the buggy demos, and the buggy demos you can translate into two things. It's like the person that's giving the demo, it's like all over the place, harbor tours. But on the other end, it just crashes.
Right.
And it starts circling and circling and waiting. And that's not the best experience you can give a prospect in that stage of the sales cycle.
Exactly.
So, yeah, okay, I understand that. And I also understand why people are saying, okay, take my money, where can I buy this? What's the opportunity if you get this right? And is it possible? I mean, what I've seen on your website is that you actually capture things. But like, how does it go? How does it, first of all, how does it work?
Right. So we have a very interesting approach to empowering the salespeople to be their own, to run their own demos and manage it and optimize and all that. We don't plug into the back end of the company, so we don't need any access to the data and stuff that are hidden. We just kind of differentiate anything that's front end and back end from your actual real product, your live, the SaaS platform you're trying to sell. So our technology just kind of separates anything back end from front end. From the moment that we've disconnected you from your back end and we've duplicated your product into our cloud environment, that basically means that your actual product can crash and burn, but your demo would still be safe. And it wouldn't crash. That's one thing. You're not reliant on bugs, freezes, glitches that are bound to happen in the live product, because everything that you captured, that's going to be the demo that you're working with, and it's already been captured. So the user gets a codeless platform where they can customize the demo, create templates for different types of clients that you have and prospects, different types of data sets, personalize everything so it fits a specific use case. You can share it with your colleagues, like the other salespeople, and you can make changes. You can get insights. If it was a good demo, if it was a bad demo, when you plug it into your CRMs also.
Okay. Now I get a little bit more, because I thought it was initially more of a screen grab, but it's actually a real product where all the features are actually functioning.
Yeah, right. It's easy to confuse, but it's not a video and it's not a design or a mock-up and all that.
Exactly. So your customer can actually take you on a route into the product without you saying, okay, well, we didn't prepare for this.
Right.
Okay, I understand it now. And I completely agree with you. That is a big problem because I've been responsible for building a whole demo environment at my previous company unit for ERP system. And we built one for professional services and for local government, for education and so on. But again, you know, since it's a live environment, if something happens during a particular day or night, the demos the next day are going to be horrible. And that's what you want to prevent.
Exactly.
So there's staging in place there. Okay. So you started the business in 2020 in August. So about 3 years ago. What has been, because I mean, sales demos, software demos have been around for decades. There's been all kind of approaches and technology to help demos become better orchestrated and so on. What was a really important decision that you took at that point that is kind of driving the success you have today?
I think one of the things, first of all, the first thing we did right was kind of be the first to market. And the market really appreciates it when you're the mover. So it was about timing. It was about market fit. It was about, you know, the immediate value that prospects saw from the MVP that we had. But I would also say you touched on our brand a few minutes ago. I would say that what happened here, which is rather unusual, is that we build our brand from day one. That was one of the strategies that I had personally as someone that knows how to do it and believes it could be a future differentiation. And today it puts us in a place where for salespeople, it's a brand, you know, it's definitely not a Fortune 500 company, but it's a brand that everyone appreciates and they know about it. And people that work at Fortune 500 companies talk about it as, hey, have you seen this? Have you seen that? They released a new video. I heard from people that is cool. We should try it out. And like I said, it's a whole landscape now. So people are very much aware, and it's only been 2.5 years of actually operating. People are very much aware of this whole thing called demos now.
Now, well, so yeah, talking about that, you're kind of putting the brand first. A lot of companies always think, okay, well, we put it later and no one knows it in the first place. What did you do in order to build a brand that was actually getting ahead of you, taking the product's motion with it? What were specific things you prioritized then?
Right. So the first thing that we did was kind of come up with like, what's the voice? What's the narrative for us? What type of a tone do we want to have? We looked at hundreds of sales products and they all had the most boring look and feel. It's always like just get a demo and like a black or a white homepage and we do amazing this, we do amazing that. And no one really cares, right? Like you should talk to people about the value and about the pain you're solving. It's nobody really cares that you're amazing and all kinds of stuff. And a lot of B2B companies, for some reason, they don't give salespeople a lot of credit. Like they can identify when you have a good positioning or a brand offering or you don't. So from day one, when we just launched our MVP and raised seed round, we had a killer website and we had a character that salespeople liked that we drew. And we had a lot of LinkedIn presence and videos that went viral. And we won a couple of awards at Product Hunt when we launched our products. And we started getting hundreds of press releases about everything that we're doing. And it's kind of a million things. Definitely not one thing, and it's not even 100 things, but you have to connect a lot of different pieces of the puzzle.
Exactly. I mean, if you would bring it down to the essence, what made it do what it did?
I will say, you know, the best feedback that I can have is what other people are thinking about our brand, because I'm not objective, but they're talking about being surprisingly clear about the value, doing it in a human way, where you feel there's people behind the screen and, you know, there's actually people here trying to help you out.
Let me make a small interruption here. Joav just made an excellent comment about the best remark you can get from the market about your brand or product. Being surprisingly clear about the value and being perceived as human. That's all it takes. Clear and human. Why? Because we're dealing with people. People are going through emotions. They have fear, frustrations, and hopes. Why do we think that just because we sell B2B software, we have to talk the language our prospects don't get? We don't do that either when we're having a cup of coffee with someone, right? Still, 9 out of 10 SaaS companies' websites make that basic mistake. So the bar is not high. Everyone can do it. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. back to the interview.
So there's a level of confidence, and you know, sometimes the humor that we use for our content could be too much. Like we're trying to test the limits all the time and see how people are reacting. What we learned is every time we take it a step further, then it goes even more viral and people love it. So we have a pretty brave type of of sense of humor in our social media, and we launched a movement that we called We Are Prospects. And
I know, saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and people really loved it. It was a few millions of people on LinkedIn that actually saw the video that we produced about a prospect, a nice lady that spilled coffee on the shirt, and she's trying to buy a shirt from the sales guy at the store, and he won't give her the shirt. He's trying to understand what pain point she's trying to solve, and he's trying to get her to sign to his newsletter, and a lot of things happen when she's just trying to buy the shirt. That just broke the internet completely. It went madly viral.
Exactly. It's so recognizable.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, I hear a couple of words. Human, hit the right nerve, which is kind of that starts with having empathy for the people that you actually help. And the movement part is about creating something that people really want to belong to. And if you combine those things together, I can only understand that growth will come fast. And what I like about it is that you talk about it, you did it from day one, you know, because so many people think and hide behind the fact that, yeah, but we don't have the budget for this. And it just starts with, like you say, tone of voice, the first blog, and then and experiment with that. And everybody can write a blog.
Exactly. So, you don't need a lot of budget for it.
Exactly. Funny enough, I mean, I've got a question here, like, what has been the hardest nut to crack to grow user adoption and change behavior?
I would say a tough nut to crack has definitely been the market education, because, you know, when we just started off and we didn't have anything to show yet, but we told people what we're building. So they didn't really get it because nothing existed. And so they were like, editing my demos, you know, that sounded weird and nobody got it. So there was market education that we had to carry on our shoulders and just do it as the first movers. Luckily today, there's other companies building stuff with hopes to work on the same product as we do. And so now the market education obviously is stronger, and lucky for us, they're investing in content and, you know, in PPC campaigns and press releases. And so the market gets educated in a much better way than if it was still just us.
And I really like the fact that you're saying that again, because so many people are actually, they're always afraid of the competition, you know, and one competitor less is better. And you're like, okay, bring it on. Yeah. Of course, it has to do, of course, building the category. And if you're alone, then yeah, you're just alone. But the moment there's more players entering the category, it first of all means there is something. And yeah, together you're building up the education, and that will actually help level up for everybody.
Exactly. Like clients, they're not going to believe it's a real thing if it's just you, and investors, they're not going to invest. So from the moment that, you know, like you said, we raised Series B rather quickly, from the moment that people saw that there's a rush to build similar things, obviously technology-wise and resource-wise and, you know, the amount of clients that we work with, it's not something that someone can just replicate, but just understanding that there's at least 10 other companies working on their pre-seed round, seed rounds, and, you know, trying out. There's a lot of them at Y Combinator also, which is also a great household name for obviously building companies. So that makes the market realize this is something that's going to be big.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, pointing on your Series B, and first, of course, first your seed series and your Series A, and then of course B, in a relatively short time, 2.5 years, you mentioned the word rush. Would you have been able to grow where you are today without the funding and just doing it bootstrapped?
I'm actually not sure. I think that this whole thing of capturing systems and turning them into this new animal called interactive demos is not a technology that existed. I think, you know, it took a lot of resources to build it out for the first time, and we're still building. And, you know, it's about 100 people in the company now. I would say it would have been nearly impossible to do with a 10 people team, or 12 for that matter.
Okay. Now, I'm always fascinated by, you know, I wrote a big essay around the vicious cycle of desperately chasing funding. And I see so many companies that go the funding way to sort of hide a problem. And you took it the other way. It's like, okay, there's a rush. It needs to be done. We have to capture that market share. There is traction going on. And this is just to fuel the fire there.
Yeah. What you're describing is the worst thing that you can do. Like you said, people think it's investors' money, so we can just experiment. Like, why would you want to marry an investor, a board member, someone that, you know, it's not someone that you can just split from if you're not happy, unless you actually found some product market fit, some initial responses, a wait list, anything that tells you people will pay for it and it will be a real business. Because, you know, I know it's not your money, right? The founder's money, but you're going to be working very closely with the person that you took the money from, and something's got to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And well, I mean, I see so many disasters and stress about, you know, chasing someone else's goals and not being able to meet the expectations, and it turns everything on its head. So glad that that's the case. You talked a couple of times about minimum viable product. How did you approach the whole minimum viable product part? Because a lot of people have from my perspective, the misconception it needs to be the minimum thing to just put something out there in the marketplace. Where others are taking another approach and say, okay, this needs to be the minimum to just get this engine going, growing fast. I mean, how did you approach it?
Yeah, we took a very aggressive approach of showing as little as we can. I think it was, you know, you could just choose one screen out of your entire platform, and you can edit it around like a Wix website. But when we showed it, the waitlist started exploding because people could use their imagination and say, if this was my entire platform, then I could do amazing demos. This was all that we showed in our MVP, and we use it to raise money and we use it to bring on like design partners. I believe that if we had spent months and months or maybe even more just building out an impressive MVP before someone told us it actually, you know, it's something they need, oh, yeah, that's you know, a waste of time.
Exactly, yeah. And you did it the right way. You created a wow factor and just a longing for, I want more.
Exactly.
Where too many just do the basics, and yeah, it does the job, but there's no, I'm like talking to my book again, there's no remarkable effect coming from it. It just does the thing. And what you did is exactly the opposite. Give them as little as possible for them to just jump on that wait list and pray for being first in line. But then you created the products and started to ship. What happened then? You know, the minimum viable product became version one.
So what happens then is that we had a wait list that was really exploding through the roof. And we said, all right, now let's go one by one and let's see which companies we should be working with at such an early stage. And yeah, we approached everyone that left, you know, their contact. And we saw some with design partners that we chose were small companies. Some of them were 10,000 people. One of them was a Fortune 500 company. We wanted to see which industry or sizes of companies get the most value of what we want to build.
Perfect.
And so we started onboarding them. I think that this is one thing that we got right, but it's really easy to get wrong. You can choose the wrong design partners, and then people will kind of shift your product strategy to other places. Lucky for us, it was choosing the right people.
Okay, but what choices did you make there? Where did you say no, and where did you say hell yes?
We took a look, you know, we saw their dashboard, and we saw if it's something that our technology around 2 years ago is something it could handle. The second thing that we saw is who the champion is. That's usually a big one in design partners. So, you know, if it's a head of sales, if it's a CRO, if it's a pre-sale engineer, if it's a marketing, product marketing, interactive demos became something today that a lot of different people need. And back then it was still unknown. So we were trying to test a lot of different people, you know, different roles, and then a little bit of guesswork also.
Yeah. Okay. But at the end, it's of course carving out who you're for, who you're not for. It's the whole segmentation game.
Right.
Which obviously goes far beyond just demographics and firmographics. Okay, it needs to be a company of this size in that region with this type of product. I mean, there's far more behind. You already mentioned like the champion behind it. And that's the people game again. What do those people care about? What do they aspire? You know, do they want to see this as a competitive advantage or just to kind of save cost? And from there on, you started to zoom into that and say, well, typically say no to the rest of them.
You know how it's like, sometimes people sign up and they don't remember. So not all of them were offended. Mm-hmm. The others we just onboarded later on when there was like the live product functioning. We just kind of sent a newsletter and it said it's up, and many of them converted into clients.
Okay, well that's good news as well. Yeah, well, the particularly, of course, going from MVP to a first product, the design partners, indeed, customers, the ones you choose there are very important. So what was the moment where you started to feel a tipping point? Or was it already right from the start?
It was a little bit early on.
Yeah.
I think the tipping point was, first of all, the first time I ever heard someone from a major tech company saying that, wow, this saved me a lot of money and time and it's great. Like, so it was 2 years ago and it was really early on. And when I noticed that the same core product is making people from different roles and different companies say that it saves them a lot of time and money and it's valuable, that was one thing, because you can have a great launch marketing wise and you can have a nice looking MVP and you can have people saying that they will use it.
Yeah.
From the moment that you actually start seeing product metrics and people actually use it, that's like a big thing. It's like getting your first investment or getting your first client signing a contract and all that. Another tipping point is, I think that when we saw the entire sales industry kind of showing interest in our We Are Prospects movement, a lot of companies, they say they have a movement and then like nothing, right? No engagement, just a landing page on your website. But when we saw that the LinkedIn audience shared it and watched it by the millions, so we said, you know, holy hell, something's working out here.
Yeah, exactly. What do you believe was the main factor why people connected so well and wanted to join the movement?
I would say that we made it so dead simple. Like, what's the pain that we're trying to, you know, to solve? Everyone understood in a second what it means to buy a shirt, but not to being able to buy a shirt. It was like C-levels from Fortune 500 companies sharing it on LinkedIn and really the highest ranking people like messaging me and saying, we get this. It's just huge what you guys are working on. There was a certain part of, you know, the audience. There was a segment that just kind of loved the humor and the writing. And he said, like, that segment of the audience, which is rather big, said, wow, you guys can really do commercials and, you know, videos and content. But this is a nice compliment, but it's not really what we set out to do. But the majority of people was like, this is a problem that, you know, how does it even exist in 2023? And they just got really connected to the video.
Yeah. Is it still going on? I mean, is this something whereby people actually unite together and level up together because it's just a different way of doing?
First of all, yeah. The second thing is that we also have like a B2B approach to that movement. And we gathered companies like HubSpot and Duly and SimilarWeb and others that have kind of said they also want to provide a better selling experience for their prospects. So it involves also other tech companies, like we let them in and join the fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because that's what it's really all about. You know, it's not about one particular feature or something like that. It's about standing for something and standing for a great sales or demo experience. Sort of almost like a promise that people are making. And if that promise is hard to keep, yeah, there you go. And there's so much to learn at the end. So that's what I like about movements in general, that it really brings people together to make a jump.
Exactly.
I talked about my book already. What I'm always interested in, since the book is loaded with examples from my first year of doing the podcast, I mean, are you optimizing anything in order to create something that people keep talking about? Is that something that is part of the design process, part of the culture of the company? And does it happen by accident?
I like to say that, you know, we did a lot of crazy experiments. Like, a lot of things here were intentional and a lot of things were caused by surprise. We didn't think the market would be educated so fast. We didn't think Gartner would write about it so fast. We didn't think people will have budgets called interactive demos so fast. You know, every time that we're working on a new video, we say, let's just push it and see if people are sick of it. You know, the last video that we published, the star of the video was a turtle named Fred that was potentially dead or maybe alive. It just helps us tell the story in a way that no other company is able to do it. So every time we push the limits and boundaries, we just find out that the experiment has been successful. And, you know, we had experiments running on the product side, on our go-to-market side, or in our sales process, in our marketing. And we're just building whatever, you know, the audience seems to want.
Exactly. And that's a good approach. You know, it's not what you want, it's what your audience wants. And
exactly.
Just hit the right nerve with the problem they're experiencing. And I always say, kind of get under the skin, that open wound, a little bit of salt on it in a humorous way. And that can get people's reaction. And there's so much noise out there on the market. You know, just look at look at the whole B2B SaaS sales space. Thousands and thousands of companies. How do you stand out? You know, and you do. You've proven it works. What would you do different next time if you had to start again?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can build something where all the stars would align as much as Walnut. It's just kind of a magical thing where everybody needs it and everybody wants it and the value is massive. I did learn a lot of things along the way. Like, you know, for instance, when you launch and you're the first mover of a market, if you do it loud, then it gets viral and successful. But then a lot of people, you know, they try to compete with you. And in different industries, that might not be the best approach. I feel that in sales products, marketing products, it's a good approach. But if you're building some sort of a heavy deep tech data automation company or a cyber company, sometimes you really need to work on your technology for a couple of years before you let other people know what you're working on. But other than that, you know, the founding team we had here was amazing. So I can't say, you know, I'll choose better people for the next time. The investors that we have are super excited. So yeah, I will just hope that the next thing is as good as one.
Yeah. Well, the question at the end is like, yeah, you said the stars align. And of course, yeah, you can wait until all the stars align. But what you've been describing, I mean, if you would have launched this in 2000, I think it would have taken off as well, and possibly even in the 90s. Of course, there was more on-premise at that point in time, but the pain is, I mean, I've been around for a while. I've got some gray hair. It's been there forever, really. Right. Yeah. So, but it's just doing it, seeing the pain and just coming up with a different approach for it. That's, I think, what really drives it. Okay, last question, looking at the time as well. From all the experience that you've gained so far now in the last 2.5 years running Walnut, and the wisdom that you've gained there, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you would like to share with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission?
Wow, I have a lot of those. I tend to say that you should filter out the feedback that you get from people. When you're building out a company and a technology that doesn't exist, there's a lot of tips you can get from people, investors, colleagues, salespeople, you know, friends and CEOs of companies that have succeeded or failed in the space. There's not a playbook. So whatever worked for other people or did not necessarily will not be the same case for you. So you have to take like the professional stuff and you have to, you know, use other people's advice, but don't let everything kind of distract you and interfere. The second thing in terms of do, I would just say that it's all people. Like you said, it's all people. It's the co-founders, it's the investors, it's your founding team, your first 10 employees, and then your first 20, and then your first 100. It's really all about them. And if they're good, it's going to be a good journey for you. If you make the wrong decisions, then, you know, it's going to be a very mediocre journey for you. So you have to focus on the right people, people that complement skills that you don't have as a founder, people that are smarter than you, people that came from great companies, and people that know what it means to work for a startup at this phase, because it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can have great people with fantastic career history that came from a scale-up that was already touching the billion. Wrong people to have, because they've learned a different trick. Exactly. Well, thank you very much, Joaf, to share the journey, this impressive journey. I'll keep following you. Likely I'll recommend you here and there to companies that require what you have, because that word needs to go out still. Where can people go to find out more about Walnut or to say hi to you?
Right. So I'm available on, you know, any social network, and Walnut is very loud on social networks. So hopefully people have come across them already, but we're very active on LinkedIn and Twitter and everywhere else, Facebook and everything. And myself also, if anyone needs any type of help, then please reach out.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And this ends my conversation with Joaf. And I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Joaf Vilner, co-founder and CEO of Walnut. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.